Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
Let's move forward. Hope you enjoyed last week's show. I was off doing acupuncture and came back with some really cool stuff, but I also had some really cool stuff waiting in my mailbox, including several questions from listeners about dizziness of various sorts. So I will tell you, it's kind of a joke in medicine. There are certain puns that don't only make sense if you are a doctor. Like, for example, there's this thing called nystagmus, where your eyes, when you try to follow an object, they'll jump around. And you may have had that experience, perhaps, if you were intoxicated or poisoned by something, where your vision is all jumpy and your eyes are jumpy. It's one of the reasons during the sobriety tests, the police officer has you follow their finger. It's also something I do in the office. And when you see that jumpy stuff, that's called nystagmus. There is also rotary nystagmus. And nystagmus is one of the features of certain kinds of dizziness, specifically vertigo. It's a sign of a dizziness that's a central nervous system mismatch between what's going on with the eyeballs and what's going on with the vestibular system, which is, you know, kind of like a three-axis carpenter's level that's buried deep in your skull that tells you exactly where your head is in space and whether it's transitioning to another position or holding still. Very important for walking around on two legs. And so we used to make a joke about patients who were difficult or who we thought were feigning or who we just couldn't figure out. And we would say rotary nystagmus, which would mean eye rolling. But, you know, it's code. So it's only funny if you're an MD. But nystagmus is a really, really important finding when you're working up vertigo versus dizziness, because dizzy can mean a lot of different things to a layperson, but it really means only one thing to a doctor, which is to say, a sensation of unsteadiness not associated with a hallucination of linear or directional movement. So if you feel like you're kind of floating around, a little bit like, oh, when you've been on a boat for a while and you get your sea legs and then you step on to a solid surface and you feel like you're still moving, that's a little taste of the residual motion in those carpenter levels rocking back and forth. And so now your brain has actually adapted to that rocking. And when the rocking stops, that adaptation doesn't. And so for a few seconds, you're still trying to adapt to the boat movement of the ocean, but it's gone. So you have, an overcompensation, kind of a interesting little tidbit. If you've ever wondered what that sensation was. So vertigo is classically defined as a hallucination of motion. And we've all experienced it as children when we whirled around too many times and then tried to hold still and we were like wobbling about and feeling like we were still spinning. That's classic vertigo. People can have directional vertigo where they feel like they're tipping to the right or tipping to the left. But with your eyes closed, it's still there. And if there is nausea associated, actually closing your eyes can make it worse. So just probably anyone who's ever had seasickness understands that. So there are maneuvers for diagnosing vertigo and also some maneuvers for helping it. And I'm going to talk about those first in this part of the program, which we're dealing with vertigo and dizziness, because I want you to have the vocabulary. So there is a very common condition, benign paroxysmal positional vertigo. And this has to do with one of the sensors going awry in that carpenter's level in the inner ear that I mentioned. The first of these is the Epley maneuver. And this is something that is done for, well, to try to put the little rocks in your head. Did you know you actually do have rocks in your head? Back in their location. So before we get started, a little anatomy. I want you to imagine three hollow donuts or curved tubes that are curved around in a circle. And inside these tubes, for the sake of our discussion, we're not going to describe the entire structure, but imagine that you have a platform in the middle of the tube, and there are little balls rolling around on the top of the platform. And if one of them falls off the platform and is rolling around on the bottom, it confuses the nerves, and they think there's motion when there isn't motion. So sort of a snow globe effect. You know, if you shake a snow globe, all the little particles flop up in the air, but then they settle down. If one of the little snow globe particles refuses to settle down, that will fool your ear into thinking that there's continued motion. And of course, your eyes are telling you that you're standing still. So it has the illusion of motion where none occurs. And when the eyes don't match the inner ear, the first thing the brain assumes is you've eaten the wrong weed and we're going to make you vomit it up before it kills your liver. And that is why nausea is such a strong association here. And well, we live on the coast here in Santa Cruz in the Monterey Bay. So many of us have experienced that seasickness at least at one time or another in our lives. But, you know, this is no fun to get randomly. A lot of times people will shake loose that rock in a car accident, or maybe back in the days when we did high impact aerobics, that was a big deal. I would see 40-year-old women coming in with this positional vertigo. And so think snow globe again. So they're fine until they make a sudden turn or they pop out of bed too fast, and they'll start that little ball kicking around and triggering nerves, and you end up with the sensation of motion, which is an illusion, but a very unpleasant one. So the trick is that down in the corner of the tube, there's a little trash basket for these crystals, because they do come loose and they do eventually wash up into this little pocket. And the trick is to try and move the head around and get the snow globe crystals to deposit there. And so these maneuvers, most of them, are designed to try to get that to happen. The Epley maneuver is the most common one that I've seen. It is very hard to do on your own, and it actually can be a little dangerous if you have neck arthritis, so I don't recommend you try this at home. But it's something that the ear, nose, and throat doctors have gotten very good at. So they move, it's basically moving your head until the vertigo is triggered, and then kind of shaking your head or pounding on it a little bit to vibrate it, to try to vibrate the rock down into the little corner where it gets trapped. There's also the Cermont maneuver, which is a series of movements trying to help the crystals. There's the Foster maneuver, which is the one I recommend to people. You can look up Dr. Foster Vertigo, and it'll pop right up on your browser. But this is a safe thing to do. You're on the floor on your hands and knees. You plant the top of your head on the floor, your hands on the floor, your knees on the floor, and you rotate your head until you trigger the vertigo, and then you stay there until it goes away. And then you come up with your head in the same position, and a lot of times that sweeps the particles down where they need to be. Now, they don't always stay there, so many times people have to do these maneuvers over and over again before the problem finally resolves. There's another one called the Brandt-Daroff exercises, and you would want to look this up. That's Brandt hyphen Daroff. And the Brandt-Daroff exercises are done multiple times a day, actually to kind of do the sea legs thing I was talking about earlier. It's to train your brain to adjust to the signals from your inner ear and thus reduce the vertigo symptoms. So this is a neuroplasticity exercise and requires that you do it frequently, probably four times a day, as many or even more. But eventually your brain habituates to this problem, and so it basically essentially neurons its way around the issue and suppresses the response. So now that you have that background, we're going to start with an email. This from Joel in Santa Cruz. And Joel writes, I'm living with both vertigo and tinnitus. The vertigo has not been too bad lately, although I've had several significant episodes over the past year, the last one this past Christmas morning. The tinnitus is ever present, first starting this past November, December. I've been to the ENT and the audiologist. They didn't offer too much in the way of help, but did say, based on the hearing test, that I do not have Meniere's disease. I'm considering additional investigation of my vestibular system. What do you think of doing a more in-depth study? Would I find out anything I don't already know? I'm doing acupuncture and drinking herbs. I think that has helped with the vertigo, but no luck yet with the tinnitus. Okay, so first of all, Joel, when you saw the ENT, I'm hoping he did these Hall Pike maneuvers, which involves lying you on your back and then twisting your head, holding your neck in your hands. It's very similar to the Epley maneuvers, except it's done rapidly because the idea is to see if you can trigger the vertigo. So it would be important to know whether that was done, because that's kind of basic. There are some neurologic testing that can be done to test this are semi-invasive. They involve electrodes. There are, of course, great specialists that you will wait 6 to 9 months to see. And it certainly would be worth trying the Epley maneuvers or looking up Dr. Foster and seeing if that makes a difference. When acupuncture helps the vertigo, one of the other things, there's two things where my mind goes, one of which is, this is kidney yin deficiency or kidney qi deficiency. So if you have salt cravings and you feel cold a lot, particularly cold feet, that would be an indication that you should keep up the acupuncture. It's probably supporting you. And as you said, you think that's helped with the vertigo. Now, acupuncture can help with tinnitus, but the very first thing you want to do with tinnitus is to get your neck adjusted by a chiropractor, a good one, and I'm not going to make any recommendations on the air, but there is a lot of tinnitus that actually gets substantially better with adjustment, and if it's going to work, it's going to work with the first or second treatment, so you don't have to spend a ton of money giving this try, and it may not, it's always persistent, so you just have to listen in. I've also been successful, not all that often, but about half the time, with early tinnitus that hasn't been around that long in particular, which yours, starting in November, December, that would count, where you do a treatment called the kidney cerebral treatment, and I believe this comes out of the French energetic school of acupuncture. It's an electroacupuncture treatment, and I would be happy to give the protocol to your acupuncturist if they have stimulators and want to give it a try. It's not trying to steal business here, but that might be worth looking at. Should you get a further workup? I would say so, yes. Particularly if you didn't have hearing drop-off. You don't really say whether your hearing was normal, but if you had just like one area of drop-off, so, you know, just real black spots, kind of like spectroscopy, then, yeah, that's nerve damage, and maybe it was too much rock and roll, or maybe it was explosions, or just being in the wrong place at the wrong time. But in that situation, you probably are looking at masking devices and cognitive behavioral therapy so that you can learn to ignore the tinnitus, because it probably won't respond to anything Western medicine has to offer. But I would certainly try the alternative things, because you certainly have nothing to lose. Laura in Cooksville, Tennessee writes, POTS. Hello, Dr. Don. I've been diagnosed with POTS, most likely long COVID. My symptoms are extreme weakness and post-exertional malaise and fatigue, reduced appetite, and weight loss of 50 pounds, sleep disturbances, and sporadic episodes of extreme dizziness. I don't think I have brain fog. and the tachycardia is less than before, but these symptoms have been going on for over 2 years. I currently take Flurinef, magnesium, CoQ10, vitamin D, and a probiotic. All meds which have been prescribed have caused me to feel zombie-like. I'm assuming except the Flurinef, which is basically a kind of mineral decorticoid. In other words, a hormone that adjusts the way your body handles potassium and sodium. Continuing with Laura, I'm currently trying electric vagus nerve stimulation and was started on what was supposed to be a graduated exercise program, but am unable to last more than 5 minutes on a recumbent bike. I have tried to keep abreast of the current literature on this topic, but am extremely frustrated by my lack of improvement. I wonder if you can recommend any other suggestions. Thank you very much. All right, so there's a lot there, Laura, and so we're going to deconstruct it. I had a few comments, and I'll try to wrap it up with some constructive suggestions. The first thing when someone comes in and tells me they have POTS, I always am like, well, how was that diagnosed? Was it, did you have a tilt table? Did they do orthostatic blood pressures on you, which is to say check your pulse and blood pressure multiple times as they tilted you up and then leave you upright? And then if you start to get symptomatic, see if your pulse has kicked up inappropriately. POTS is basically where your blood pressure drops because your heart is beating too fast. And the other type of fainting is a reflex. I had a patient do that in my office today after a Botox shot, actually. And in her case, and this is the typical syncope or faintness, she lost her color in her face and her pulse slowed down and she dropped her blood pressure and became faint. So it's the Goldilocks phenomenon, right? Too slow a pulse, no bueno. Too fast a pulse, also no bueno. It has to be just right. And so it's really important to know if you have the POTS because a lot of the answers contextually are different. The long COVID diagnosis, of course, there are a couple of things that we could do that might validate that. You could look at your interleukin 1 and your interleukin 6 levels and see if those were abnormal. You could get an autoimmune panel and see if you have antibodies against a lot of self-antigens. It's sort of like, oh, a touch of lupus, a touch of Sjogren's, a touch of elevated thyroid antibodies, but none of them are high enough to really be diagnostic of that disease. It's just like a low-level immune system simmer, and that is very characteristic of long COVID. Of course, another one, you mentioned weight loss and poor appetite. How's your sense of smell? Because that would be one of the things that you could be constructively targeting if your sense of smell was impaired. It would also really point to COVID as being the source of this. And again, trying to figure out whether you belong in that long COVID track versus the myalgia encephalitis track, which is what's been called chronic fatigue syndrome, chronic Lyme, you know, mold toxicity, lots and lots of things have been lumped into that. You mentioned that you can't last for more than 5 minutes on a recumbent bike. So my follow-up question there would be, okay, so you get exhausted easily, but are you flatlined the next day or the day after? Because when you have what's called push-crash syndrome, where even a small amount of exercise doesn't just make you tired at the moment, but your recovery takes days. In that situation, we start looking for toxicities. We start thinking about the mitochondria. We do start thinking about Lyme disease, although you're in Tennessee, so there might be some other tick-borne things like babesiosa and anaplasma that you'd want to think about as well. But, you know, doing a tick panel, those are widely available, might be reasonable if you have that push-crash syndrome. weight loss is not especially a long COVID thing. So I'm looking at that and going, all right, whether she had toxicity as the source of this, when a person loses 50 pounds, they drop a lot of lead and mercury into their system. And you mentioned tachycardia and brain, and the tachycardia is often, you know, very, very commonly a post-COVID syndrome, but there's all sorts of other things that can cause it. And tachycardia itself can cause symptoms of weakness and post-exertional malaise. So I would, and because of the weight loss, I think it would make sense to get urine organic acid analysis, which is just a pee test, and it looks at your mitochondrial functioning. And if there are backups in that pathway, we can get an indication for that. It also would be worthwhile to get heavy metal testing. And that's always a big topic in terms of, well, how do I do that? Get tested for lead and mercury. Blood tests really aren't going to help if the weight loss was more than a couple of months ago, because these materials don't hang around in the bloodstream very long. There are provoked tests, and I don't know about a local functional medicine doctor in Cookeville, but certainly in the major cities, you could find one. You could go to functionalmedicine.org and put your zip code in to find a practitioner. And, you know, you're looking for someone who is a certified functional medicine practitioner on that website, because they will have done the training to at least make the diagnosis and refer you on if they don't feel comfortable doing the treatment. Now, in terms of treatment, for the mitochondria, I have a little recipe here that I got from a cardiologist. So there's a 5-carbon sugar called D-ribose, and you take about 5,000 milligrams, that's 1 teaspoon of a sugar. It's not as sweet as table sugar, but you can put it in your tea or put it in some water, 3 times a day. And L-carnitine, which is an amino acid that promotes the production of energy in the mitochondria. And for that, you'll need around 2,000, 1,500 to 3,000 milligrams of that a day. And that can be purchased rather inexpensively online as a powder, or a little bit more expensively as capsules. And CoQ10, and we would want you to be getting the ubiquinol, ending in OL, and about 300 milligrams of that daily. And this recipe will really kick people's energy up if it's a mitochondrial exhaustion issue, which it could be, very well maybe. The last thing I would suggest, and this is if the IL-1 and the IL-6 are elevated, or those antibody tests I mentioned are elevated, is going on low-dose naltrexone, which requires a prescription, but it's a very safe drug. We typically give 50 milligrams of this stuff every day to people who are trying to quit drinking. Unfortunately, the 4.5, you know, less than 10% of that dose, will not have that effect. But what it will do is it will send a message to your immune cells to calm down and stop spinning their wheels, so to speak, and attacking things that don't need to be attacked. So it is an immune modulator. It would also be worthwhile to get a vitamin D level and make sure that your vitamin D level is at least 70. And if it's not, start taking about 5,000 units a day. And check in 3 to 5 months to see if it's up there in the 70s. And then you can cut the dose, because vitamin D is stored in your body fat. And so once you get the level back up, you can just keep it topped off with a lesser dose. So I think I've covered all of the points that I had for you, and I sure do hope that something that I've included in here will actually help. Hello. Welcome. Tell me your name and where you're calling from.
I'm Patches in Santa Cruz.
Patches. Okay. Very good. What can I do for you, sir?
Well, I'm in my early 70s. Well, I guess I'm in my mid-70s. and I have fairly severe Dupuytren's contracture.
Oh, boy.
And I've been utterly frustrated with the Medicare responses to my condition. And honestly, many years ago, when this was first, when I showed it to a doctor I was gardening for, he said, "Oh, yeah, it's that Norwegian alcoholic's disease."
Oh, well, you don't have to be an alcoholic, but it helps to be Norwegian.
Well, apparently. And that's actually part of my query. I mean, you're probably aware that here in Santa Cruz, you can either have the surgery or the injections.
Yes.
And I have had the injections in my right hand.
Oh, tell me how that went.
What?
How did that go?
Well, that's an interesting question, because when I had the injections, I thought I would be cured. And in the immediate wake of the injections, the surgeon with Palo Alto Medical Foundation said, "Well, this is very temporary. The only thing that can really be permanent is the surgery." But he didn't even tell me that until he had done it.
Mm.
And it did work. I was able to, my fingers reached out again. I was able to do that. But and he was right. That was a temporary thing.
How long did it work for you?
I would say, I think it started to return within 3 years, 2-3 years.
Mm-hmm. And were you doing any stretching exercises or anything?
The injection is remarkably expensive.
Oh God, yes. But
it amazes me. It's like it wasn't as expensive as surgery, but it was clearly kind of a racket. Somebody had a patent on the drug.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he told me. People who owned the patent made most of the money on the injection.
Yes.
The whole thing was over in a matter of a few minutes. Very painful injections, but in and out, you know, he stabs you through the palm of your hand.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I guess and now I have it. I'm an old man, and I can't do a lot of things now because of the crippling of my fingers. And I don't know. I guess, Dr. Don, do you know something I don't know?
Well, which fingers are involved? Are they all involved, or is it's usually
no?
It's usually ring.
Little finger and ring finger.
Yeah, it's usually those two, and so
that's why. In fact, I have read this in literature, in those old medieval pictures of a pope raising his hand, and there was speculation that he had Dupuytren's contracture.
Well,
the little finger and the ring finger were bent down. Only the thumb and the other two fingers were up.
Well, you know, there might be something to that.
Perhaps. It's academic, obviously.
Yeah, it is. It's funny. It's a funny thought, though. Actually, what is it? Okay, so let's get what we call a quality of life analysis. What are the things that you want to be doing that you can't do because your fourth and fifth finger are kind of out of position?
I have, not that I'm at this stage of the game using a keyboard of any kind tremendously, but I have to hunt and peck now, because when you have one or two fingers curled down, they'll scrape the keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to hunt and peck. You can't. I used to be a very capable typist and writer, and that's gone. I can't play a guitar anymore. I can't play the banjo anymore. And I mean, I can play the auto harp and I can play the dulcimer, but I miss those things. They were quality of life sorts mm-hmm. of things.
Yeah, well, that's why I asked, because and particularly when we don't have kind of the hurly burly of raising children and putting food on the table quite so, you know, going to work every day, all of that. Those are the things that you were going to like do a lot of, and they're meaningful. So in no way do I want to minimize it. I just wanted to see what they were, because sometimes there are suggestions. So,
and there are, I mean, innumerable other things. I can't clap my hands. I can't do push-ups because I can't put a palm down. Or I can do push-ups, but I have to do it in a fist position. And I do a lot of gardening, and when I have a handful of weeds and try to throw them, they hook around those fingers and they fall back on me.
Oh, boy.
I mean, there's just...
You're going to have to work on...
No, it sounds...
It sounds meaningful to me, because I understand about the quality of life issues. So I have a couple suggestions. There are... Remember, you're not alone here, and there are lots of people who have had strokes or nerve palsies where the nerve's been damaged and they've got fingers that are in a claw because they've lost the ability to extend the fingers.
Uh-huh.
And eventually the fingers just tighten up like that. And
yeah.
So the surgical release, I don't understand your insurance situation, but the surgical release, because it's a surgery, and the way the star chamber that runs Medicare is very procedural heavy.
This is what I'm up against.
Yeah.
I won't name names, but in the insurance that I have through Medicare, I did the, you know, Medicare Advantage thing, and now I'm limited to who they send me to.
Right. Yeah. And what's the wait for the surgery? Like 10 years?
Well, it wasn't that so much. It was, I just did not trust this surgeon.
Ah, okay.
I met somebody who had somebody, and I saw their scars, and I was like, that's not so bad. And she was like perfectly happy, and gave me the name and number, but I could not go. When I saw what the results were from her surgery, I think it was a woman in about 67.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so she had little scars, right?
Oh, very
yeah.
narrow.
Right. So
very
she
very narrow.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I've also met people who had been through the person I was sent to, and they looked like their hand had gone through a garbage disposal.
The difference is whether you do an open or a closed procedure. In the last dozen years, we have moved to doing from doing open procedures where we have to cut the skin all the way open to get a look at what we're trying to reach, to these tunnel procedures where we use effectively a periscope, if you will. And that goes into a little cut that's maybe 5-10 millimeters across, and then it follows
the line of the contracture.
And then you have these specialized instruments that go in there. And there's also robotic surgery now, which is even the next level. And, you know, the old to boldly go where no man has gone before, you know, with Star Trek and all of that. But we are now, the robotic surgery, actually, there's a doctor, Dr. Titan at Dominican, who's doing amazing work with the robot. And she's freeing up people with severe endometriosis in areas, you know, way down behind the bladder and back down there in the colon and rectum pouch that you just can't get to at all with regular surgery. You know, you can't get there from here, but you need those little pipes, and you need the robot that can get in there and hold things. And it's amazing what they can do. And so there's hope that the surgery will become, that the laparoscopic surgeries will become more, you know, will become learned by more people and become more broadly available.
I am so glad to hear that, but I don't know if there's any hope of me ever being able to get there.
Well, the first thing I would suggest you do, because I don't know, and it's hard to honestly, it's hard to recruit people to this area, but you may be able to see someone within your Medicare Advantage plan that's out of the area. And you really should inquire within that entity. The okay. other thing you can do is talk to a Medicare, like the AARP and the local senior center. They have people who help.
That.
Yeah, and so what's the circumstance for your Medicare Advantage? Can you exit it, or are you? Do you have a buyout?
I am prohibited from going outside of my network.
Right, that's right. As long as you're an Advantage.
The whole thing that Ralph Nader talks about.
Yeah, but can you exit? Can you exit
out of it?
Yeah, can you exit Medicare Advantage? Because a few people I know have been able to, and it had to do with some kind of finesse. And I don't know the backstory on that, but I've been telling people for years, don't sign up because you will be trapped in the panel. And
that isn't,
if you've got something that requires finesse and you have it, you know, and I'm not saying this is not a good surgeon, but obviously it's an open procedure versus a closed procedure. Nevertheless, how's the function of the people with the ugly hands? Because as you pointed out, you're in your mid 70s. So I'm betting that. I'm betting that it's more about hand function that you're concerned rather than hand appearance, right? Is that correct?
Mm. Yes.
Okay. So there might, you know, getting an open procedure from someone who does a lot of open procedures, you want someone who does 50 a year of this procedure at a minimum. You'd like to have someone who does more than that, but in a small area like ours, you know, you've got to keep your surgeons busy. They may not have enough cases to just do this kind of surgery.
Well, but you're probably acquainted with who's doing this work.
I am, but in terms...
I don't want to name names, but...
You know, I've heard the most awful things said about me. And, like, not only untrue, but, like, they had the wrong girl because I had left that office 5 years earlier and, you know, it still showed up on my Yelp. So I really don't pay attention to, you know, bad outcome horror stories because it's possible for the best surgeon in the world to have a bad outcome. This is like, you know, trapeze artists and some people fall. That's why they have a net. And you can't necessarily count on doing it absolutely perfectly and having the person heal correctly. And in the case of one case I was involved in, having the person actually follow your instructions and then, or just not follow them and then lie about it. So that's just the world, right? That's people. But
it is.
So in your case, I think you got to prioritize. First, think in terms of you want to get back to the banjo. Is it worth being ugly to get back to the banjo? If you had a 80% chance, 90% chance of being back at your instruments and you had to, you know, give up a toe or, you know what I'm saying? It's kind of like, what are you willing to trade for that quality of life piece? And if you can, and certainly go and see if you can exit from your Medicare Advantage plan.
It's too late. I did. And I blew it because it was the tail end of March was when you could get out. And I lost it.
Okay, so
I could not make up my mind, and now I'm stuck for another year.
Okay, but it's another year. And in the meantime, for the typing and the writing, I did want to point out the latest version of Windows, and I'm sure Apple iOS has the same thing, has really excellent voice-to-text. And so you get yourself a trackball so that you can run the cursor around with just your thumb and your index finger, and it doesn't really care. A mouse is much harder to do because you've got your elbow up, but if you get a trackball, your curled fingers will fall pretty naturally into the position, and with just a pillow under your elbow, you'll be pretty functional in terms of, you know, moving your cursor and tapping things. And then with the voice to text, you can dictate paragraphs, dictate entire stories. It's really good. And it's finally here. I've been waiting 30 years for voice to text transcription to get to the point where it's worth using and not, you know, either hilarious or excruciating. So I think it's there, and it's probably built in if you have the latest builds on that. And if you don't, then, you know, get someone to help you or do it yourself, upgrade the operating system, because you've got that in your pocket already.
Dr. Don, it's very kind of you to suggest those things, but honestly, at my age, as a Luddite,
are you telling me you don't even have a desktop?
No, I don't.
Okay. All right. Well, I
have a telephone, though, as you...
I figured that out.
No, I have a telephone, and I'm glad I have a radio, because those are about my only... I guess I would be a reformed Luddite, or I wouldn't even be able to have this.
Well, I'm thinking that we all may become involuntary Luddites before too long. So I'm going to sign off now. I hope I've helped you, or at least helped you adjust.
So thankful, and I'm glad I had a chance to talk to you.
Well, thank you for the call. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm going to break into this story. And first of all, I want to make a comment about telling the truth about important things because of the unintended consequences that can occur. And it may seem like a harmless lie, but sometimes those really backfire. And in the case of this, we're going all the way back to 2006 when a paper published in a very prestigious journal, Alzheimer's and Dementia, suggested that amyloid beta, a particular one called AB56, could cause Alzheimer's. AB proteins had long been linked with the disease, but the authors reported that AB56 was present in mice genetically engineered to develop an Alzheimer's-like condition, that it built up in step with their cognitive decline. And the team also reported memory deficits appearing in rats who were injected with AB56. Well, that's got us started on a false trail. And for years, researchers tried to improve Alzheimer's outcomes by stripping amyloid proteins from the brain. In fact, a new drug, which is actually being marketed, in fact, one of my relatives is being offered that drug for his mild cognitive deficit. He's actually not demented at the level where you would expect to be treating him. He has a 24 on his test and 26 or above is passing. So as far as I'm concerned, this is a mild impairment, but he does have memory issues. And so now we have a drug that was approved by the FDA last year. I'm going to add, over the objections of the panel of experts who were supposed to review the science. And they said, thumbs down, not good enough, do not authorize this. And it's out there and it is being hyped to the practitioners as the latest, greatest thing because it reduces beta amyloid. And there's very, very soft. The drug is called Leqembi, and it modestly slows cognitive decline, modestly, but it has serious risks of fatal brain swelling and brain bleeding. Let's just say that again. Fatal brain swelling and bleeding. Now, if a certain percentage of people given a drug have a side effect like that, the drug had better be a bombshell in terms of effectiveness. If it just has minimal benefit, you've got to ask yourself, what is it worth it? Is it worth the cost? Is it worth the risk? Almost certainly not. Now, in 2022, a retraction of this paper was printed in Science because researchers had looked at it, and it had been cited at that point nearly 2,500 times, which would make it the most cited paper ever to be retracted, because the authors actually falsified the data. And when people really took a close look at it, the technique that was used to purify this amyloid beta 56 could not be replicated. Now, there are other, it is absolutely true that Alzheimer's brains often have high levels of amyloid beta. They also have high levels of tau protein. Now that we have non-invasive scans, brain biopsy doesn't exactly help here because you can't biopsy a living brain without doing some damage. Now that we have MRIs and other kinds of scans where we can look at amyloid and tau protein, which causes the neurofibrillary tangles, the other thing that we were seeing in Alzheimer's, we see that you can have a lot of amyloid beta and no Alzheimer's. You can have a little amyloid beta and a lot of Alzheimer's. So it doesn't correlate particularly well. Lots of people who have amyloid beta in the brain have no symptoms and no cognitive loss. But that tau protein, the neurofibrillary tangle protein, that one tracks with the Alzheimer's, that tracks with the memory loss, it tracks with the cognitive distortions that are the hallmarks of this disease. And we now have non-invasive tests like blood tests looking at a particular breakdown product of tau protein that can be found in the blood. And that is still a quote-unquote experimental, in that I don't think you can get it paid for by your Medicare Advantage, but it is coming. And I think for the standpoint of life planning and knowing, you know, what decisions to make and what commitments to make over the next, say, 10 years in a situation where you could reliably know that you probably will not be able to drive, you'll need help paying your bills in a decade, you would, you know, this average person in their 70s would make a different set of decisions. And also, we're beginning to have evidence of things that actually do slow or prevent the progression of Alzheimer's. Many of them are in the clean up your act category. The End of Alzheimer's by Dale Bredesen, if you are suffering from any kind of cognitive deficit, if you actually follow the protocol in that book and clean up your act, you might be amazed at the improvements that you will notice. And there are not just case studies, but some placebo studies that are suggestive that you can see improvement with just lifestyle. The trouble is, lifestyle, well, it's hard to come up with a placebo for exercise that will make the person think they're exercising, but they're really not. In any event, it matters so much that researchers be ethical and bring to the table accurate information, because this wrong turn on the level of the Donner Party in terms of disasters, we wasted a lot of time sniffing down the wrong trail, and that is truly tragic. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.